This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. It's estimated that just under 6 million people in the U.S. are living with Alzheimer's, and that number is projected to rise to nearly 14 million by 2050. Every 65 seconds, another American is diagnosed with the disease. The causes of Alzheimer's are not yet fully understood, and we're learning more all the time. What does the latest research tell us about Alzheimer's? Are the scientists closer to finding a cure, treatment? What are some early warning signs of Alzheimer's, and what would treatment look like? And what are the roles of sleep, stress, diet, and exercise, what do they play in preventing its development? And you can call in with your questions and comments to 210-614-8977 as we talk about how you can change the destiny of your brain. 210-614-8977. You could email us at thesource@tpr.org. Our guest this hour, we're joined by Dr. Shuda Seshadri. She is a professor of neurology at UT Health San Antonio, founding director of the university's Glenn Biggs Institute for Alzheimer's and Neurodegenerative Diseases. Dr. Maria Carrillo, she is a chief science officer for the Alzheimer's Association. And Jenny Funk is with us. She's a programs and advocacy director at the Alzheimer's Association San Antonio and South Texas chapter. And again, the number to call in is 210-614-8980. Dr. Maria Carrillo, with the Alzheimer's Association, can you kind of give us a better idea of how big of an issue Alzheimer's is for national public health?
Absolutely, and thank you very much for having me on the show. It's this is such an important topic because across the country there are over 5.5 million Americans living with Alzheimer's or related dementia. It's important to talk about because I think many times we don't understand certainly the burden, unless you've experienced it yourself in your family with a loved one, the burden and the toll that this disease takes, and that there certainly is support available for it, certainly the Alzheimer's Association being one of those and others as well. But the other aspect I think that we don't talk about in terms of public health is the years of disability that one will end up living with if it is an Alzheimer's-related dementia because of the continuous decline that happens over the course of what could be anywhere from an average of 7 to 9 years, but upwards of 20 years. And again, that disability, the need for that 24-hour care and the increasing needs as a person lives with this disease, that toll it takes on their loved ones and the care that's required is extraordinarily not only burdensome for the family, but also for our public health offices. I mean, we're talking about having to require that 24-hour care that sometimes families must then turn to institutions that might help them, so care, long-term care facilities and nursing homes, and many times then on public aid. So we work very closely with governments to also make them aware of this public health crisis overall.
And Jenny Funk with the Alzheimer's Association San Antonio South Texas chapter, many people really dread this disease for a number of reasons, but it seems to be all closely associated with the loss of self as our memories are eroded away. The cognitive function also is destroyed as parts of our brain begin to die. People, they recoil in horror. Frequently, when they don't even want to hear this conversation because it can be very difficult. But I want to emphasize that we're going to have a message of hope for individuals and some very actionable information about how you can change the destiny of your brain when it comes to Alzheimer's. But you're seeing though how people are dealing with it today. And if you are 80 years old or older, you're either going to be suffering from Alzheimer's or a caregiver with Alzheimer's. So this is something that's very impactful, right?
Absolutely, yes. And thank you as well for having us on today to have these really, I think, frank conversations about a topic that truly no one wants to have to talk about or listen to. But as you said, the prevalence of this is so strong. And we do meet families on a daily basis who are either just on the journey or they've been on this journey with a loved one and they've had a crisis happen. And they they do feel like there is, if they don't know about the Alzheimer's Association or other resources that are available, especially in the amazing community that we are in, they can feel so isolated, get so focused on taking care of their loved one and their health that oftentimes the caregiver's health declines quicker than the person with the disease. So it is extremely important that, yes, we know the more that we spread awareness and we can get this listed as a true public health crisis, individually for families, we want them to know that they don't have to be isolated. They don't have to be on this journey. It's very difficult, I think, at first to call a stranger on the phone or attend a support group where you're going to be talking about such personal things. But the overwhelming feedback from families is that when they do it, and it's heartbreaking to hear this, but they always say, I wish I had done that months ago. I wish I had done that years ago, because I would have started on a path of, yes, it's helpful to talk about this. It's helpful to get caregiving tips. And just how do you get through the day when you're taking care of someone and all the different things that can come up? And no two people are alike who are experiencing this, but there are so many commonalities that just talking about it can be really helpful. So there are a lot of support services available, again, through UT Health, through the Caring for the Caregiver, through the Alzheimer's Association, and so many other organizations, that it is important that if you are on this track or you have concerns about a loved one, reach out and call us, and we can start the process of getting support and help.
And so, Dr. Seth Chaudhry, there's a lot of research going on. You're overseeing a lot of different areas of research. But if you could just touch on this one point, and we'll dig in a little bit deeper. Is your fate sealed when it comes to whether or not an individual is going to get Alzheimer's?
Not at all. Thank you, David, for devoting this important hour to this important topic. And thank you, Maria and Ginny, for joining me here. We absolutely represent the hope that dementia can be prevented, and people with dementia can have their disease slowed, their quality of life optimized. And that is what the big center has been set up a little over a year ago to do: provide comprehensive, compassionate, multidimensional, personalized care for everybody, whether they are just worried because a parent or somebody had Alzheimer's, or whether they have advanced disease and need multiple resources to optimize quality of life. If I have a minute, in Texas, we have 380,000 people living with the disease today. Texas is the second highest in the country, the state with the number of deaths. And part of this is because Texas has 2 in 5 Texans are Hispanic, and Hispanics seem to have an even higher risk of developing Alzheimer's as compared to others. However, when you come to the drug trials and clinical research that can really prevent the disease, Hispanics are very underrepresented. Another big caregiver burden: for every one person with Alzheimer's, 3 people have their lives affected as caregivers. And in Hispanics, it's even more.
All right, well, we're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about some things you can do in your lifestyle that could greatly increase the odds that you're not going to be touched by the dementia and Alzheimer's. The number to call in if you've got a question or a comment is 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about protecting your brain from Alzheimer's. The fate is not sealed on what your brain's future is when it comes to this degenerative disease, how you can change the future of your brain, some simple things that you can do, some lifestyle alterations that will probably make you feel better to begin with anyway. The number to call in is 210-614-8980 as we talk about the state of the science about Alzheimer's. And David is on the line, 210-614-8980. David, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Good morning, David. This is a tremendous show. I'd like to just ask a question. If the doctors on your program have heard about this book by Dr. Dale Bredesen. It's a New York Times bestseller. It's called The End of Alzheimer's, the first program to prevent and reverse cognitive decline. Dale E. Bredesen,
yes.
M.D.
All right, we're getting some nodding heads that they've heard it. Yeah, so let's get some comments from them and see what they think about it. Thank you for the call, David, and bringing that to the table. So, Dr. Seshadri?
Thank you for that question, David. We are aware of the Bredesen Protocol, and by and large, it puts together a number of lifestyle interventions that have an overall beneficial effect on the health. They've not been proven to prevent Alzheimer's, unfortunately. In fact, the Alzheimer's Association, as I'm sure Maria and Jenny can speak to, has taken a lead in initiating a large study in the U.S. called POINTER of lifestyle interventions that may prevent the risk of Alzheimer's. This is part of a worldwide collaboration called Worldwide Finger Study based on some initial promising study in Finland. What we do know is that, broadly speaking, what is good for the heart is good for the brain. And this means controlling your blood pressure, remaining physically active, and remaining cognitively engaged seem to be very promising interventions. Another important thing is it's not a question of beginning at 60 or 70, but the earlier in life you begin, the 40, the 50, that is when the first changes of Alzheimer's are happening on your brain, even though you don't even know it. And that's the time to bring in the lifestyle interventions. Sleep is another thing that's very important. 7 to 9 hours seems optimal. And it's not just the sleep, but the quality of sleep. If you have breathing disturbances during sleep, like sleep apnea, and that causes micro arousals, that seems to be bad. If you have less of the dream-type sleep, REM sleep, that seems to be harmful. If you have a kind of kicking around too much during REM sleep, REM behavior disorder, that could be a sign of early dementia. So that's one of the things that we can do. All of us today probably get much less sleep than we need to. And during sleep, the amyloid in the brain seems to be cleared through pathways called lymphatics and paravascular pathways. Stress is another universally challenge that we all face these days. And some stress is energizing and good. But high levels of cortisol in the morning have been associated in a large study called the Framingham Heart Study, where I've been studying participants now for over 40 years. It seems to shrink their brains even when people are in their 50s. Not so much that you can tell, obviously, but enough that we know it increases the risk of dementia later. And diet is something that where we know, generally speaking, a heart-healthy diet with a low salt is good to prevent strokes and in that way to prevent dementia. And it may be good also for the specific amyloid and plaques and tangles that characterize Alzheimer's disease.
Dr. Maria Carrillo with the Alzheimer's Association are familiar with the book End of Alzheimer's, and particularly I think there's something in the book they mention cognoscopy.
Yeah, we are very familiar with it, and you know, as we've already heard from Suda, it's something that we get a lot of questions about. I think one of the things that is most interesting about the book is that this RECODE protocol that they use, and the title itself, I think, can be a bit misleading. And I think David, your caller, is right about asking the question because the title is "The End of Alzheimer's," the first book, the first program to prevent and reverse cognitive decline. I think that there's, as you just heard from Suda, the possibility of maybe slowing cognitive decline as we age has been demonstrated in various studies of lifestyle. Certainly in Finland is one, and you've heard a little bit also about the Framingham Heart Study that tells us a little bit about lifestyle and helping us protect our cognitive health as well as our overall health. But I think that a reversal, especially of Alzheimer's, has not been proven. And I think overall what we have done is to launch a study ourselves to try to evaluate lifestyle interventions and help us create a recipe that is evidence-based with 2,000 over adults around the country participating in it, so that we can see if there is, in fact, a way for us to say that you can use lifestyle to prevent cognitive decline and maybe even delay or avoid dementia. This study is called the U.S. Pointer Study. You can find information on ALZ.org. It's a lifestyle intervention trial to support brain health and prevent cognitive decline. And it will combine two different methods that are looking at four lifestyle examples, which is physical exercise, nutritional counseling, cognitive engagement, and improved health medical management, so cardiovascular risk factors, diabetes, et cetera. So these are the four interventions that we're going to work on in this study of 2,000 people across the country in the United States already enrolling, actually in North Carolina. That's the way in which I think is an evidence-based approach to move forward and explore how far we can go with a statement about lifestyle and its impact on the brain. We know that it's good. We've heard what's good for your heart is good for your brain, but what is that recipe to follow? And as you've already heard Sue to say, Dr. Bredesen's book does not quite have that proven evidence base to say it can end Alzheimer's.
Right. Maybe it might help us make the case for people to adopt these lifestyle changes to, if they understand how they will help prevent Alzheimer's. And so let's kind of go over what we think causes Alzheimer's, and that we know that we have the synapses in the brain and we have the buildup of this gook in there, and that if you're not taking care of yourself, then the brain janitor is not doing a very good job of getting rid of that goop out of the brain. And so I'm sure, Doctor, you can say that in a much smarter way than I did.
I think you put it quite well. So Alzheimer's, what we understand today, is characterized by the presence in the brain of two types of proteins in a sort of abnormal form. One is an amyloid, beta amyloid protein. When these pieces get together as small clumps called oligomers, they seem to provoke some inflammation, damage some of the surrounding cells, and that seems to result in difficulties with the memory pathways. This protein called amyloid also worsens the function of a protein called tau, which is sort of a railway track or tram carrier track inside the neuron, where many proteins and chemicals produced in the body of the neuron need to get carried for relatively long distances to the end of the neuron, where they can then act at the synapse. And this protein, tau, gets clumped in abnormal hypophosphorylated tangles. And this combination is what Alois Alzheimer in 1901 described, and what we think is at the root of Alzheimer's disease. Now, what we call Alzheimer's disease when we see a patient who's losing memory and thinking abilities can sometimes be a mixture of many things. And we are still understanding all those different things. And that understanding the complete picture will enable us to come up with many treatment strategies, some of which may be right for each patient. For those of your listeners who want to understand more about the science as well as the prevention, we have a Dialogues on Dementia at the Tobin on the 24th of February, where Dr. Carrillo and a number of national and international experts, as well as faculty from our own BIGS, will be available to answer questions in the form of talks and a panel discussion.
I'm going to go to a caller, 210-614-8980 with Becky. Hi, Becky. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wondered, my grandmother passed from Alzheimer's a few years ago, and I wondered if that increases the likelihood that I may get it, or if I should be more attentive to prevention, if that makes a difference.
Becky, thank you for your call.
Thank you, Becky. May I ask at what age your grandmother developed the disease?
92.
Thank you. So we tend to divide Alzheimer's into early onset and later onset, and the dividing line is somewhere between 60 to 65 years. And for family members, first-degree relatives of people with later onset Alzheimer's, The risk is increased about 3 to 5 times, but it does not mean that it's not necessary or sufficient just having a family member, particularly if it is somebody who developed the disease quite late in life. So what I would say is that doing the things that prevent dementia starting early in life is probably good. In terms of the specific genes, what we know is there's a gene called apolipoprotein E. If people have the common 3-3 variant, most people do, some have an E2 that's protective, and some have an E4 that increases the risk. And today we know of another 30 to 40 genes that act together in various combinations to increase risk as well. We don't yet have a way to tell you precisely an individual's genetic risk. So overall, it's important to understand that family history is a modifiable risk factor because there are also gene-environment interactions. So the environment, even if you have a lot of the genes that would cause the disease, changing the environment can weaken the effect of those genes and keep you from getting the disease.
But if you have a family member or family members who have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, it raises the likelihood that you may get it, and then that you should pay particular attention to these lifestyle changes, because just because you have these genetic markers that say that you may get it, there are things you can do to increase your ability to fight it off, right?
Yes. I do want to say, though, that for people in families where the disease begins very young, in the 50s and early 60s, there can be some proportion of people who have a mutation where if you're carrying the mutation, you are very likely to develop the disease.
Are there some slam dunk genes?
Autosomal dominant slam dunk genes. Now, those are being studied by a dominantly inherited Alzheimer network that's worldwide. And there, it's very important, I think, to go to the attention of experts and perhaps enroll in clinical trials where the focus is on helping prevent the disease. I want everybody to sort of realize that we are not trying to make people feel guilty and say you're developing the disease because you didn't exercise enough or sleep enough. We don't know enough to have any such firm prescription. These are broad generalizations.
And right. So, but we have genetic testing that I can mail in to these corporate companies all the time, you know, this 23andMe and all these companies, and they will tell you if you pay extra money what your genetic makeup looks like. And is that something that I should really believe, that they're going to tell me what the odds are I'm going to get Alzheimer's, you know?
So,
I'm just going to Dr. Maria Carrillo, really quick.
Thank you. This is something the Alzheimer's Association talks about a lot, because we get questions about genetic testing, and there are many genes that can increase your risk, but one in particular is being sold through this, available test like 23andMe. It's important for people to understand that, you know, that it's still not a guarantee you're going to get it. It's a risk. Already knowing you have a family member like your caller is that already tells you you're at an increased risk, and it's important to understand that there are insurance and perhaps other healthcare coverage implications about genetic testing. So be very careful. Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to talk more about Alzheimer's and you, protecting your brain, changing your brain's destiny. What are some things you can do, particularly sleep? We're going to talk a lot about sleep and the importance of sleep when we come back from the break. If you want to tell us your story, ask us your questions, 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this quick break. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davis. We're talking about protecting your brain from Alzheimer's. Was handed a flyer here, 10 ways to love your brain. One of them is hit the books. Want to butt out, stop smoking, follow your heart, take care of your cardiovascular system. Heads up, brain injury. You know, if you're not wearing your seatbelt, that's probably the worst thing you can do for your health. You got to take care of yourself. You got to take care of your noggin, your noodle up there. Wear a helmet if you're on a bike or a scooter. Fuel upright, eat good food, get your sleep, take care of your mental health. Means have a positive outlook on life. Do everything you can to talk about your issues and have a positive look on and deal with anxiety. Buddy up. You know, engaging with people making new friends. We know that looking at new faces and them smiling, you smiling at them and smiling at me, that creates a lot of positive activity in your brain, and break a sweat. Get that brain heart pumping. Those are some things you can do to love your brain. Let's go to the phones, 210-614-8980 with Rob. Hi, Rob. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Go right ahead.
Well, I had a question. I had read something recently that there may be a connection between the condition of tinnitus, the ringing in one's ears, as a precursor to Alzheimer's, that it might signal that there's a problem there with the brain being able to shut itself off and rest properly.
All right, Rob, thank you for the question. We get a lot of questions like that. Another caller couldn't hang on. He wanted to know about gum disease and the connection to Alzheimer's. So let's go first to your doctor. Go ahead.
Thank you for the question. With regard to tinnitus, it's a very common condition, and we don't have any evidence specifically linking this buzzing or ringing in the ears to an increased risk of Alzheimer's. What we do know is that tinnitus is a sign of injury to that eighth nerve, which also is responsible for hearing. And we know that decreased hearing appears to be a risk factor for cognitive decline and dementia. This could be partly because it decreases the input that's coming from the outside into the brain. And so correcting hearing loss is important. So if there is tinnitus, it's very important to see the doctor because it could be a sign of some things. Sometimes a kind of tumor called an acoustic neuroma can start off as tinnitus. In many people, this could be just a sign of too much exposure to very loud things like occupationally or music, and so reducing that could help the tinnitus. And if there is associated hearing loss, that is something to treat and correct because that can increase the risk of dementia. With regard to gum disease, there is in fact a little more evidence that gum disease could increase your risk of heart attack, stroke, and dementia. And this may be because the microbiome, the bacteria in your mouth and gut, seem to have a very important effect on our health, which is something we are beginning to understand. And periodontal disease changes the microbiome in your mouth. It also promotes a sort of chronic inflammation. And we know inflammation is something that's bad for many organs in the body, including the brain.
So Dr. Maria Carrillo with the Alzheimer's Association, you know, we get a lot of these questions, people trying to make these connections about things that they've experienced in Alzheimer's, and it shows you that folks are very engaged and they're very curious, but they don't have a lot of solid information to work off of, and they're trying to connect the dots on their own. So all the more reason why we need to be investing in solid science to figure out what's happening with Alzheimer's. Is that one conclusion?
I think absolutely. I think the two major takeaways is that, you know, all of these things that you hear people are very concerned about all revolve around general health. And I think overall health is critical. I mean, gum and dental health, oral hygiene is important, ensuring that you protect your hearing. And if you need a hearing aid, go and check that out so that you can get help, so that you prevent any cognitive decline that could be due to, chronic hearing loss in a person who might be then withdrawing from society even more over time because they can't hear. So all of these things are just about good health sense. But to be honest with you, some of them do give us hints as to underlying perhaps causes or contributors or maybe accelerants of what could be underlying biological changes. And you heard Dr. Seshadri, for example, give an example of the microbiome and gum bacteria. So these are things that even though, you know, again, overall health can help us and protect us, but can also give us clues into the underlying pathways. We do understand today that Alzheimer's and related dementias are incredibly complex, and there won't be a silver bullet of one magic, you know, pill or injection, but knowing about all of these in the background of also aging, which also causes just even healthy aging. It causes changes in all of our body, and in addition, in our brain, have to be studied. The good news is that the Alzheimer's Association, our public advocacy has worked. Our sister organization, the Alzheimer's Impact Movement, has also made great strides. And today, because of our Alzheimer's Impact Movement work, we have managed to increase the federal dollars from $450 million just 5 years ago to $2.35 billion today. We know that our own contribution as an organization has reached $435 million through the charitable dollars of all of our generous donors as we contribute to research ourselves, and that over time, these new dollars will help us find the answer. We've done it before for other diseases and where we've made those investments, and we will do it for Alzheimer's and related dementias as well.
Well, when I look at something like balance, a person's sense of balance, and we know that there's lots of ways the balance is a function of the inner ear. And if you lose your balance, it could be just a physical loss of the ability to monitor that, or it could be a cognitive function failure as well. So if you have something that's flaring up and showing, oh, I've got gum problems, or I've got thing in my ear, or this other half, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have Alzheimer's, but should it tell me that I should be going to a doctor and getting tested and check it out, doctor?
It absolutely means you should be going to a doctor and having it checked out. As Maria said, your general health is very important. Even with, just this week, there was a paper that said, even with the same amount of disease in the brain, if you're overall in frail health, you're more likely to have the symptoms of dementia. And we know that Medicare requires that above the age of 65, when you go to your primary care, they check out your general cognition as well. This can be challenging in the short time available for a visit. And so there are many approaches to kind of prioritize the people who most need this cognitive assessment. And your primary care doctor is the best person to sort of advise on further expert evaluation and testing. But many places, like the Biggs Clinic, also offer a healthy brain clinic where, if you're concerned, you can be assessed and a sort of personalized, what are the things you can do given your blood pressure, your cholesterol, your blood sugar, that sort of thing. You can have a discussion with your doctor.
So Jenny Funk at the Alzheimer's Association of San Antonio and South Texas chapter, you have people maybe their first time, I just got the diagnosis and now I'm going to come to you, and people, they're probably dealing with, they're pretty scared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Overwhelmed, anxious, fearful, sometimes anger. There's so many different emotions. So the first thing that we recommend is call the Alzheimer's Association, because we do have a 24/7 helpline, which means midnight, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, we always have staff available round the clock. And as a nationwide nonprofit, that means no matter where you are, if you have a phone, you can reach a staff member of the Alzheimer's Association and ask questions, get resources, express. Sometimes people just need to talk and know that the other person understands what it's like to feel all of these different emotions, and how do you handle different things, different caregiving techniques? How do you give someone a bath who has refused for 3 weeks at a time and feeling guilty about getting so angry with your loved one when it feels like they're doing these things on purpose, but we know that they actually aren't? So first thing we do say is call the Alzheimer's Association. We have a 24-hour helpline. And then we absolutely encourage, take classes. Learn about the disease. Learn about resources, that you're not alone. We work very closely also with the Area Agency on Aging, and they have all kinds of programs that are available. Support groups. Again, people hesitate and it can be so difficult, but the feedback is that if you go into a place and you actually can talk about these things with other individuals who just understand. They may be further along in the process, they may be just getting into it, but getting tips and suggestions and just being able to get personal at that level. Before I came here, we have an early stage support group for individuals who are in the early stages of Alzheimer's or another dementia. And one of the caregivers that was there said, you know, this is our lifeline. This is a weekly group that we just look forward to every week. And that just means that means everything. They just being able to have that conversation and talk with others and share that, yes, you're not the only one in the world that's going through this, and that there are resources. You can learn more about the disease and techniques to deal with just different behaviors that your loved one might do. And how do you start that discussion of getting additional help, whether it's in the home or actually, like in our family's case, having to actually move our mother into long-term care? And that's something you never think that you will ever have to do. But we talk about, even if you have this incredibly large family that's super well-functioning, even those families end up needing additional help when it comes to if they have a loved one with Alzheimer's. You end up needing help. So we want to be that resource to have those discussions and help link people to resources, because there are a lot in our community.
And that's the Alzheimer's Association, San Antonio and South Texas chapter. If you've got more questions about Alzheimer's, how to protect yourself to disease, do you have a family member or loved one with Alzheimer's, we do want to hear your story. You can call in. The number is 210-614-8980. When we come back, we're going to dive into nutrition and Alzheimer's. What's the connection there? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about protecting your brain from Alzheimer's. 210-614-8980. Jose is on the line. Jose, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. Wonderful program. I'm a physician. One of your doctors mentioned about inflammation in the brain. I think it's very important what we eat. Because, for example, sugar produces inflammation in the brain. And I think I have seen some research, mainly from Europe, that very low fat in the brain also damages the neurons. I think it's in the 1960s we've been getting away from fat and eating more sugar. I think when I went to medical school, it was in the 70s, and the disease, I don't think it was that common like it is today.
All right. Doctor, thank you. Jose, thank you for the call. People are living longer, so we're seeing that that's part of the reason why we're seeing so much more with it. And a lot of people are talking about fats in the brains, but omega-3 is something people talk about. So, Dr. Seshadri?
Thank you for that question, Jose. And thank you for pointing out sugar-sweetened drinks we know are bad for you in many ways, metabolic disease, diabetes. We did a study at Framingham that showed it increases the risk of dementia, doubles it. And many places are trying to cut back, particularly in childhood, which is when people develop a taste for that, to have them have less sweet or just plain water rather than sugar-sweetened drinks. And that is something. In terms of the right diet, this may vary from person to person. And as Dr. Maria Carrillo already pointed out, the POINTER study will be looking at different dietary interventions as one aspect of it. We do recognize that when somebody gets a diagnosis of the disease, it's hard to know what to do next. And that's why there is a counselor, both personalized counseling as well as support groups. The Biggs works with the Alzheimer's so that they are not duplicating but are supplementing. We've started a Lewy body and disease and support group for children of people with early onset Alzheimer's. We also make sure that people have access to occupational therapy, strategies for maximizing the quality of life, to dietary advice, as well as a sort of comprehensive, if there are behavioral issues, talking to the psychiatrist and so on. Every week almost, there are caregiver-focused, caring for the caregiver sessions, because we know that caregivers have a much higher risk of health problems. And what determines the quality of life for the patient is often the health and mental and physical well-being of the caregiver. So one of the areas we are closely researching, Dr. Carolyn Pickering at the School of Nursing at UT Health, is this dyad of caregiver and patient, or person with dementia and care partner, and what are the factors that together we can optimize the quality of life for both of them.
And Dr. Maria Carrillo for the Alzheimer's Association, can you talk about the role nutrition plays?
Yeah, absolutely. And I, as you can imagine, we, like Dr. Seshadri, get this question quite a bit because there are so many things out there that claim to prevent or reverse cognitive decline or even dementia through diet. We have not found, as I think you've already heard from other experts, any one thing that actually can prevent any type of dementia. We do know, though, that physical well-being is critical, just as Dr. Seshadri has said, specifically regarding diet. I will share with you that the Mediterranean diet and the MIND diet, is the Mediterranean/DASH intervention. These have been studied significantly in clinical trials and have been shown to be beneficial to brain and heart health. So we encourage everyone to eat, typical healthy diets like those. They're just, low in saturated fats. They're high in fruits, vegetables, and nuts, and good fats. And of course, you've already heard from Dr. Seshadri, diet is not the only contributing factor to healthy aging. Physical activity is important. Socialization is important. Genetics play a role, but, again, are not the end-all and be-all, because our lifestyle can actually impact that and help us, if not prevent, and maybe even delay. But until we study this more specifically in our U.S. Pointer study, we won't have a recipe that we can bank on. But for now, please, yes, nutrition is critical, and the MIND and MIND-DASH Mediterranean and MIND-DASH diets are those that you can look up online and find more information on. They are healthy diets.
And a MIND diet is leafy greens, vegetables, berries, fish oil, omega-3s. Let's go to Damien. Hi, Damien. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to know, are there any supplements out there? Because I know that they have a few supplements that say improve your focus and memory, such as Prevagen. But are there any supplements that we can take over the counter that will help improve our memory or at least curb Alzheimer's?
All right. Thank you for that question. So Dr. Seshadri?
There is no evidence that somebody who's on a healthy diet taking additional supplements is going to reduce their risk of dementia. There are some people who have lower levels of certain vitamins like vitamin B12 or folate, which can then result in downstream changes, which can hurt the brain. So if your levels are low, then supplementation may be required to bring it to a normal level. Similarly, for vitamin D, if your levels are low, bringing it up to a recommended level with supplements could help your bone as well as your heart and your brain.
But we hear about the sleep connection with Alzheimer's, and once you become symptomatic with Alzheimer's, getting a restful sleep becomes more difficult. What about taking something like melatonin to try to help you give you an edge to get good sleep?
This is something I would recommend deciding on in consultation with your care provider. Often there are simple things like what we call sleep hygiene. The activity level goes down, the home is sort of made more peaceful and darker, and these things can be effective as well in improving the period of time the person is able to sleep. If medications are required, the right medication for that person may depend on, are they having agitation along with the sleep disturbance, for instance. Melatonin is a fairly mild agent, which may be right for some people, but rather than just do it over the counter, I would recommend discussing it with your physician.
Dr. Maria Carrillo with the Alzheimer's Association, are you concerned about quackery out there? A lot of people making big promises, selling these things online, some things we don't even know what they're actually taking. Is that something to be concerned about?
I think we always have certainly that concern because we get so many questions about supplements and other natural, things that one could take. As I think you've already heard from Dr. Seshadri, it's very important to consult your physician every time you want to take one of those. Even if it's a supplement, you just don't know if there might be some interaction with current medication you're taking or if it just might not be the right thing. We also have to be very careful that many of those are not as tightly regulated as our actual over-the-counter medications might be, or even our prescriptions, our prescription drugs are by the FDA. And so nutritional supplements can be iffy. We do ask that you know, you try to get information from your physician if ever you want to try something like that. We also have an 800 number, 800-272-3900, that it operates 24 hours a day all around the country, where you can just ask a simple question, and we'll try to get you the answer. If not right then, we will definitely try to get you an answer on any question you have about supplements.
Another caller. This is Teresa. And Teresa, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. I was wondering about the Alzheimer's and dementia patients who have to be fed. I used to go to the nursing home to feed my aunt. And I understand that the feeding has graduated to people who can't swallow. So they have a little tube that when you press it, it puts air into the mouth of the person, and a little sponge where you push the food very gently so that they can back so they can swallow it. What's happening to the patient at that time with their memory? Are they forgetting to eat? Are they forgetting to swallow? Or what is the problem there?
Teresa, if you
could answer that question for me.
Yeah, thank you for the call. So that seems to be late stages of Alzheimer's and shows you where it could lead to. So, Doctor.
Thank you for that call. This is obviously a heartbreaking situation. And different things such as feeding tubes into the stomach, PEG tubes, have been recommended by some people. It's very important that people make individual decisions while they're still able to do so, to discuss advanced directives and to discuss, particularly if you suspect you may be in the early stages of a dementia, because the reason there are swallowing difficulties may be because Alzheimer is in the later stages a disease that affects the whole body. The person becomes frail. There are certain types of dementia where swallowing can be an early problem because of it affecting the muscle and nervous system. There are also, as you said, people can just have very poor cognition, so they're not able to feed themselves and chew. And some people will decide that at that point they do not want exceptional measures to keep their nutrition up, and that is a personal decision for the person and their loved ones. And you can avoid some of these heartbreaking decisions if these decisions are clearly and collaboratively made. And the Alzheimer's Association, as well as centers like the Big Center, we have a clinic called the Comprehensive Care for Persons with Dementia, for people with moderate to severe dementia, where a palliative care physician will speak with the family and address some of these issues. There's no one single answer that's right for everybody.
On Sunday, February 24th, there's going to be a panel discussion titled Protecting Your Brain from Alzheimer's Disease, and that's the role of sleep, stress, diet, and exercise. It's free and open to the public, and you can register at biggsinstitute.org. I want to thank all of our guests this hour, Dr. Shuddha Seshadri, and also Dr. Maria Carrillo and Jenny Funk with the San Antonio Alzheimer's Association. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.